Well, this is now where a brand new science comes into play. And it's very critical because this science has a historical background in a spiritual realm, but will make sense in the context of new science. And it deals with this. When we want to look at the structure of the environment, we're looking at the structure of matter in space. That's actually a mathematics called geometry. The function of geometry is to plot structure in space. Well, the geometry that you and I learned in school, Steve, that was called Euclidean geometry. Remember that one with the graph paper, compasses, and all that stuff? And what we create, spheres and cubes and cylinders and all that kind of stuff. And these were beautiful, and they're actually very important because architecture really heavily depends on Euclidean geometry to create the structures that humans build. But in contrast, the question is this. Does the Euclidean geometry we learn in school in any way relate to the environment? In other words, can you use that compass and pen and pencil and that protractor to create a tree, a mountain, or a cloud? And the answer is no. Although we have to admit that when we were in kindergarten in first grade, we did make Euclidean nature. Remember the first trees that we drew on those papers were like little cylinders with a ball on the top, and that was a representation of a tree. But that's not a real image of a tree. So basically it says Euclidean geometry is not a geometry of nature because you can't reproduce the structure of nature in that. However, a new geometry appeared about 100 years ago that was the brainchild of a French mathematician by the name of Julia. And Julia created a very simple geometry. And in fact, it's based on repeating the same equation where you solve the equation and then take the solution to the equation and reinsert it back into the equation and solve it again. And you repeat this process infinitely. To give you an example of this kind of equation, which actually is called an iterated equation, this old familiar one, it says like, here's the equation, take a line and cut it in half. Well, in an iterated equation, what you do is then you take one of those halves and you put it back in the equation, which is take a line, cut it in half. Now you've got a quarter of a line. Then you take one of those quarters and you put it back in the equation, you cut it in half. Now you got an eighth of a line. And the question is, well, how many times can you put that line in there and cut it in half? And the fact is, well, you can do it infinitely, but you have to keep magnifying the image because the line keeps getting smaller each time you do it. But it's an infinite progression where the outcome of the equation is fed back into the equation. This is the nature of a fractal equation. Well, the problem with the fractal equation, at least for Julia, was in order to plot this on a piece of paper to see what would be the consequence of doing this an infinite number of times is he didn't have an infinite life to do it in. It takes millions of repeats of the equation before you can actually see an image. Well, he didn't have that much time in his life or his graduate students to actually plot what a fractal would look like. He had an idea, but he could never conceive of it. In fact, the first time a fractal was actually visualized was back in 1980s with a mathematician that was working for IBM by the name of Mandelbrot. Mandelbrot took the idea of Julia's equation and put it into a computer at the time, and then walked away and let the computer do the millions of calculations of repeating the equation over and over and over again. And he came out with a very interesting shape that many people have seen, a basic fractal. It looks like a snowman or a beetle bug, like that. And what's very interesting about this is if you take that image and blow it up and keep looking deeper into the image. Just like, remember, we could blow up the how many times can I cut a line in half infinitely as long as you keep blowing it up. Well, what they started to find is if you blew up this image, it created the greatest and most beautiful complexities and very organic in character, looking like animals and plants, most of the images in some sense. But there was another very important character to the fractal geometry. Not only did it create these beautiful images that were organic, but as you would blow up the image, you would start to see an image reappear that was self-similar. And every time you blow and go deeper, another self-similar image would reappear and another self-similar image. And it basically says, look, you're using the same equation and repeating it infinitely. Ultimately, the equation creates an image that repeats itself in a self-similar fashion. So as you're looking into this fractal with a microscope and going deeper and deeper into the fractal, the images start to reappear as you keep going deeper and deeper. And so inherent, and this is the beautiful part, inherent in a fractal geometry is that the images are self-similar and repeating at different levels of organization at higher or lower levels of the structure, the same self-similar images reappear. It's sort of the concept of Russian nesting dolls, where you open up one wooden doll and inside is another doll. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty similar to the first one. And you open that one up and inside is a smaller doll, which again is self-similar, not exactly the same, and open that up. And you can infinitely open these dolls if you can keep making them smaller and smaller. Well, why is this relevant? And the answer is, fractals by their nature repeat the structure over and over again at any level of the organization. And so in a truth, and this is very fundamental, the concept of as above, so below is an inherent integral part of fractal geometry, because whatever image is seen above, you're going to see a self-similar image below that will be a parallel to what's going on. And now here's the next connection. While Euclidean geometry cannot be used to create nature, fractal geometry does. That you can take a fractal equation and throw it into a computer and get a structure of a tree that is as real as any tree we've seen in nature. You can take a different fractal formula and get a picture of mountains with clouds that is just a mathematical representation. Or primitive-looking organisms and animals can be created. So the interesting fact is, the Euclidean geometry we learn doesn't relate to nature, but fractal geometry, you can throw a number into the equation and generate the structures that are familiar in nature. So nature, by its structure that we see out in real life, is actually a fractal geometry. Well, this is fabulous for the following reason. If nature is built on a fractal character, then it says if you could understand the structure at any one level, then you should be able to see a self-similar structure repeat itself at different levels of the organization. So nature is built on a series of self-similar patterns. And so the relevance about that says then, if nature evolves and organisms evolve in nature and they're recognizable in a fractal geometry, then the evolution of organisms in nature is not a random event, far from it. In fact, you should be able to predict in a self-similar way what the evolution will be if you can understand the evolution at an earlier or later stage of that development. And so why this is relevant then, we bought into, hey, this world is a whole series of random events. And I would say, Steve, hey, so what's tomorrow going to bring us? And you'd have to say, hey, it's random. I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring us. And then I say, wait. Civilization, biology, nature are all built on a fractal geometry. And therefore, it says whatever is going to happen tomorrow, in some sense, is going to be a self-similar reflection to what has already happened before. Therefore, we can use this geometry and go back in history or forward in history and recognize where we are going to be going. This is completely different than Darwinian theory says, hey, evolution is random, so I can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow, and I don't care, even if you know what happened in the past, it's not really relevant to what's happening tomorrow. So let's apply this, and let's look and see what's going on. And here's what we have to recognize. There's a repeating sequence of events that evolution is associated with. When life first appeared on this planet, it was represented by little miniature organisms like bacteria called microorganisms. These are not the kind of cells that make up our human body. They're very simple, primitive. They're just essentially a little bag of cytoplasm surrounded by a membrane. And these organisms, while we look at bacteria like they're living as independent elements, we recognize, no, they're not. Bacteria live in community. That the information that one bacteria recognizes about the environment can be translated into genes. That just the way Karen showed how an environment can change the genetic expression. And that once the environment changes the genes of these bacteria can then transmit the genes to other bacteria in their community using things like viruses as a way of sending genes that they've created to other elements of their community. So it turns out the nature of life has always been communal. The sharing of awareness. And awareness, as we talked about earlier, is the foundation of evolution. As a matter of fact, the evolutionary tree we designed in biology is a hierarchy of increasing evolutionary awareness, starting with the primitive organism like the bacteria at the bottom of the tree and ultimately evolving to humans and humanity at the top of the tree.